Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes.
Hi, Valerie and Monique. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast with me this morning. We connected on LinkedIn, as I do with a lot of my guests, read some of Valerie's stuff. And Valerie, you suggested that we invite Monique to join us this morning. We're going to have a great conversation, something I think that is certainly relevant, timely. Inauguration was earlier this week, so a lot of the world has perhaps become a little more optimistic just in the last couple of days. I like to think that that's the case. And maybe after our conversation today, we'll even all feel a little more optimistic even after this today. But before we dive into our topic, how about we just let the two of you introduce yourself? You want to tell us who you are?
Sure. Thank you for having me, Jason. So my name is Monique Curry-Mims, and I am the principal at Civic Capital Consulting. We are a Philadelphia-based but international social impact firm that works with nonprofits, foundations, and government agencies to create sustainable collective changes in our communities.
And Valerie, who are you?
I am the Director of Institutional Advancement at Pathways to Housing PA, and I also write a column for Generosity, which is a local publication here in Philadelphia, and I'm on the board of our local Association of Fundraising Professionals.
Yeah, so Valerie, I think it was your article that was in the most recent publication that I read, certainly caught my attention, very bold, very assertive. I appreciated everything that you said, and so I reached out and said, hey, let's have a conversation about this. I had a number of guests, probably about a dozen or so guests on the podcast last year, talking about similar issues, similar related questions in our space. And now we've turned the corner on 2020, sort of put that year behind us, and we're in a new year. Valerie, since you wrote the article, how about we let you tee it up and just sort of summarize what the thoughts were there, and then we'll just dive into it. And let's just go back and forth and hear what you have to say.
Sure. So I actually wrote an article inspired by a conversation I had with Monique, which was, you know, we've both written articles for Generosity. We both talk about a lot of the same things, which would be systemic issues with fundraising and how white privilege has kind of reared its ugly head in how we do everything that we do as fundraisers. So we had a conversation. We talked about why folks listen when I say it and perhaps don't listen when Monique says it. So I ended up up writing an article and kind of posed the question to our larger group of local fundraisers, why do we only listen to people who look like us? Why do we look to people who look like us when we're looking for insights into our profession? Why don't we listen to a more diverse range of folks? Why don't we listen to the thoughts and opinions of those who are most affected by the kinds of things that we're trying to correct through fundraising? So that's what I wrote about. And I got way more LinkedIn likes than I normally do, which just reinforces that white people listen to white people.
So Monique, Valerie's article, the title article, which is, I'll read it here. Why don't white fundraisers wake up to the inequities baked into our chosen profession? Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that? Why don't we wake up?
I mean, I think that there is a, I'm just going to say, bastardization of philanthropy, right? You know, my most recent article was entitled "Moving Beyond Philanthropy," or that was kind of the summary of it. Like, we need to move beyond it because, you know, philanthropy is based in the understanding of love for humanity. But when you think of love, like, is love unconditional within philanthropy, right? You expect to have your name on a building. You expect to get, you know, certain programs established in your name and your honor, but are those the things that are really needed to move those communities that your dollars are going to forward? So I think that one, philanthropy ends up being, well, we have these white donors over here, black donors don't necessarily have the capacity to do that. So, you know, and then white donors feel as though they're more comfortable with white donors. I mean, in particular, you know, I worked for an organization where, you know, I was having some issues with a board member. And when I started asking around as to why, it was, well, you're black and poor, and you have no reason speaking to me and my network about money. And it's like, wow, like, I was hired to do my job. I've been doing it successfully for the last 4 years, but now, you know, there's a problem because I'm not on the level of those people, so I should not be speaking to them. So I think that, you know, that kind of hinders people, especially people of color, from progressing because no one's listening to them, right? Like, you're not in our network, you're not in our circle. We're going to stay cliquish, we're going to stay here. And I think that that kind of perpetuates this cycle and really begs the question, like, where's your love, especially when your dollars are going to help people that look like me?
One of the things I thought about as I was reading your article, I didn't know if we were actually talking about fundraising specifically or if we were really talking about the bigger context of philanthropy in a much more general sense. Because a lot of these conversations that are being had, and you guys are reading a lot of the same materials in the books and the articles that I am, I'm sure. And it sounds like we're very much on the same page that a lot of this has to certainly be reconciled with a past that we sort of have in our society and culture today. But are we really talking about, you know, two generations of fundraising professionals? And fundraising, I oftentimes refer to as sort of being in its messy adolescence. I don't think even collectively we're much older than we were, you know, in high school, right? Collectively, like, if we're like a bunch of teenagers running around in a high school building or something with a lot of inferiority complexes. Are we talking about fundraising, Valerie? Or are we actually talking about philanthropy?
We're talking about both, I think. And I, to my detriment, use those terms interchangeably and probably shouldn't. But the entire, I mean, I've heard the phrase nonprofit industrial complex so much that it doesn't even really have a definition anymore. But it kind of is the entire way that the structure of nonprofits and philanthropy is set up with systemic racism, with white privilege, with all of those barriers in mind. So it really is structured to cater to the whims of wealthy white folks. That's why nonprofits were created. That's because, you know, it was the non-wealthy, non-white folks that needed the help and the wealthy white folks to provide it. And then philanthropy kind of grew up around that. And that's why our practices are the way they are. That's why our organizations are run the way they are. So it all really feeds into each other, really.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this. I'm sure both of you are familiar with the Robert Smith story that played out at Morehouse College a couple of years ago. Smith gave I want to say it was like 40,000, I mean, 40 million plus dollars. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. Thousands, not even close. Right. Yeah. Forgive me. $40 million to basically wipe out the student loan debt or any sort of obligations. And Monique and Valerie, one of the things I noticed is that was being discussed on social media. And I'm not going to type anyone who was sort of was flinching the way that they were. I thought that was an extraordinary move on his part. I got to say, I thought it was remarkable. Right. But it was so obvious, like shortly thereafter, it was like nobody would dare critique. I mean, here's a, you know, historically black college benefiting from a African-American gentleman who gave extraordinary wealth. And I think it threw people off. It was like, wait a minute, why that's not, somebody doing that's not supposed to be a black gentleman. It's supposed to be an old white guy like that looks like me. Right. I mean, right. Did you guys see? Is that some of what we're talking about?
Oh, I think it's definitely that. I mean, in the part that you left out of that story about Smith was afterwards he was investigated. It was like,
of course he was, right. It's not supposed to work that way, right?
It's not supposed to work this way. Whereas if any other person not of color gave that money, no one would have batted a second eye, nothing, right? And it was like, wait, how can he actually do that? Let's investigate his businesses and his practices. And I think that, you know, I was having a conversation with my husband around fundraising and the idea that, you know, we just have to really start looking into our communities and to people like the Smiths. And he kind of said like, yeah, but they just got their money, right? Like you fundraise with people that's old money. In Philadelphia, we have the Main Line, and the Main Line is filled with old money, with the Hesses and with the, you know, like it's money that's been there for generations. And like they just got their money yesterday. Now you're going to ask them to give it up. And that's why there's not a lot of philanthropy, because there is some hesitation. And I think that because the shift that's been happening recently within our world, a lot of those people are like, okay, now we have to do more. Like, we know we just got our money yesterday, but we have to do more. But yeah, like there's a shift that's happening. And even the way that we approach things, I'm a member of AFP, so I don't want to dig too deep on it. But, you know, we were just having a conversation that, you know, I often don't like going to events because they're just not applicable to what's going on in the world. The way that they're talking about how to fundraise, the way that they're talking about how to pursue things, it's like, I've never encountered it that way. Like that does not align with how I actually have gotten proceeds. So like, there's a shift happening that we need to adjust to.
So if we figure this out, Valerie, if we figure this out, do you want to be a fundraiser in 10 years? Or do you think that the system has to be completely overhauled where some of what we're doing now is unnecessary and irrelevant?
Oh, you're taking it really big. So
you wrote the article. I'm just riding your coattails.
I think in an ideal world, and Monique and I have talked about this before, but burn it all down and start over. Like, we shouldn't need the nonprofits to do. I mean, housing, you know, should be a basic human right. We shouldn't have to have housing organizations that provide homes for people. And we've also talked about what leads into, you know, needing a home, that there's so many factors that play into someone eventually becoming homelessness. There's trauma, there's poverty, there's intergenerational issues. There's so much that plays into it. And the entire system is broken, right? Like, it's not just one thing. It's not just, you know, this area that needs to be fixed. We really need to start all over, but that's not, you know, that's probably not possible. We probably can't just completely start over with how we provide our services and how we support people who live in our country. So in a smaller level, I would really love to be in a fundraising place in 10 years where a gift like the Morehouse gift is not something that shocks everyone into silence. You know, I think the donor knew what was needed for his community. He knew what his community needed, and he provided the support that was needed by that community. And that was shocking to a lot of us, because that's not how philanthropy works right now. His name didn't go on a building. His money didn't go into supporting the structures of the college itself. His money went directly to the people that needed it. And that's not the way most fundraising happens right now. So, you know, in an ideal world, I would love to burn it all down and start over. But because I can't do that, I would love to be here in 10 years where a gift like the Morehouse gift is not, you know, a shocker to us fundraisers. We're all just kind of like, yep, that's right. These are the people that needed the money. Thank you for giving them the money. We're going to move on now.
So Paulo Freire, for our listeners who are not familiar with Freire's work, was an educator in Brazil. But he talks about this thing called narration sickness. It's the idea that the teacher, the expert, whoever that superior person is at the front of the room, sort of gets the privilege of telling the story. And whoever gets to tell that story, whether it's an accurate story or not, that's sort of the way that the world works. And I think in some ways, like, let's say we just scrap. If we were able to scrap everything at sort of the point at which Smith made that gift at Morehouse, and I'm grateful that both of you are very familiar with that particular story. But if we sort of started there, I don't think any of us here today want Smith to not have achieved perhaps what he achieved that got him there. And I don't know that we want him to not have been compelled to give that gift. And I don't think that we want those, perhaps, I don't know how many young men were beneficiaries of that, but I don't think we don't want them to be to experience the generosity of what the gratitude of what it means to have been given such a generous gift. And I think if we get our roles right, maybe in 10 years that can be sort of, that's a much more optimistic sort of way of looking at it. But what's your thoughts on that? Either of you can jump in there.
You know, I agree. And I think that going back to the question of, is this about fundraising or philanthropy? Yeah. I think it's about the social impact sector as a whole, right? Because a lot of the work that goes to supporting these young men, these young women, you know, these families in need, it stops at a certain point, right? You know, Valerie and I were literally just having this conversation yesterday. You know, if you think about, you know, children in foster care. So you provide funding for them in foster care. And then when they age out, what happens? Right? Like there's no continuation. There's no support after that. There is a pipeline of services and philanthropy that has to go around some of these issues because they are systemic. And if we're not realizing that, then your dollars are only going but so far. Yeah. You know, and especially when you have donors that are not giving general operating, right? It's like if you're not giving general operating and there are systemic issues and wraparound services that are needed, we're actually doing a disservice that, you know, they can't get past where they are to even give. That Morehouse gift, I still have student loans. You know, they're calling me for donations. I'm like, I still owe you money. Like, let me finish paying this off because I'm not in a space to actually write those checks right now because I'm still writing them to student govs, but I'm praying that Biden erases that and I can now give you some money. But now that he's erased that for them, now they have the opportunity to give back because he provided that service. Like, you got the education. Let me remove the hindrance for you to give back. Yeah. There has to be some forethought in what we're doing.
Yeah. What'd you think, Valerie?
Completely agree. I would really love to see more of a systemic approach to philanthropy in general and not just supporting one cause or one organization. And also, I mean, I think you touched on something important, Monique, which is general operating funds and our role as fundraisers in educating our donors of the importance of general operating funds. Kudos to whatever fundraiser worked with him on his gift and kind of explained what the impact of that would be if needed. He may have just done it on his own. I'm not sure how that relationship happened. But, you know, it's kind of our role. It's our job to talk to our donors about what the impact of their gift is if they give general operating versus just giving to a program. And I don't know how many of us do that because we have, you know, goals that we need to meet that aren't related to general operating and we just kind of roll with whatever the donor tells us. And I think that power imbalance that you were talking about, Jason, really comes into play there. You know, the power tends to be with the donor and the fundraiser and the experts on the nonprofit side are really the ones that need to be that powerful role in the relationship to tell them what they need, not let the donors tell them what they want. So,
I think if we're talking about fundraising in particular, I think it's actually the experts. So Freire would put the experts in sort of the narration sickness sort of context. And what I'm getting at there, my critique, if you listen to the podcast, any of my regular listeners would know this. I got more issues with the experts out there that are trying to sort of define the way that fundraising really works.
It kind of takes me to the community-centric fundraising model, which is kind of says don't let the donor relationship rule the fundraising relationship. So I think there's a fine line there. Like, I like a lot of what you're saying. And I think that, you know, in terms of training, there is no standard training for fundraisers. There is no, you know, standard undergraduate degree that you get or graduate degree even that you get for fundraising. So a lot of us are learning from our peers. And if our peers are all doing it the way it's always been done, then that's what we learn. Yeah. And then as we get older and, you know, grow our own brains and start to unlearn a lot of what we've already learned, which is a lot of what I've been doing over the last few years. But on the flip side, the community-centric fundraising model is letting the community tell you what they need and then providing it, as opposed to letting the donor tell you what they want to see. So that's that fine line of the donor relationships, where you need to have a strong enough relationship with your donor that you can guide them and not the other way around. And I think because of a lot of the systemic racism and white supremacy built into fundraising, donors come into it thinking they're in the driver's seat. So it's really difficult, especially as a young fundraiser, to build those relationships, but stay in the driver's seat, because the donors have been doing this for a while and they know what they want and they're going to tell you what they want. And if you want their money, then you feel like you have to do it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that because they're used to it being a certain way, they believe that they can dictate. And they do dictate, right? I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard you can't tell them what to do with their money. And it's like, I'm not telling them what to do, but I'm telling them where the need is. And the need isn't where they're trying to give it. Yeah, but you can't tell them that. Like, I've heard that repeatedly. And it's just like, but that's where our need is. That's where our student need is. Like, why would we not show them that? Why would we not tell them that? And I think that as much as we try, and there's a lot of, you know, younger donors coming up, but the old guard is there and they're still strong.
And then you think about this gift that Mackenzie Scott gave. I don't think she wants anything to do with being the center of anything. She's like, here, take this money. You know, my jerk husband, you know, I got
especially
it.
Especially when they did it, it was Bezos' ex-wife. It was never Mackenzie Scott. Wife just gave, I'm like, this is not her money. She made this decision independent of him. Why is his name even in this article?
Well, but I think isn't it the experts that are sort of telling us how this works? Mackenzie didn't tell us how this works.
Well, so I think the difference between the old guard donors and some of the donors that you just pulled out, like Robert Smith and Mackenzie Scott, they're marginalized populations. They're not used to being able to dictate everything. So, you know, Mackenzie Scott gave money to HBCUs who are run by the same community that benefits from that service. So they know what their community needs best. And she wanted to give them that money and let them do it. It's the same thing with Robert Smith. What the old guard doesn't understand or, you know, doesn't really do is listen to the communities that they're giving to. They're used to being in positions of power. They think they know what's best. So a lot of nonprofits are serving people of color or other marginalized populations, but they're mostly funded by white people. So if the white donors in that situation feel like they have a say over how their money is spent, they're not really listening to the community that is receiving those funds and receiving that benefit. They're telling those communities what they're going to receive. So I think that's what speaks most to me about community-centric fundraising, is we're not allowing the wealthy white donors from the old guard who think they know what's right to make the decisions. We're allowing the people who are directly affected by the problems to have a say in what the solutions are.
And I think that, but I think that Jason does have a point, because those old guards donors, they're still listening. They're still getting consultations from the old guard fundraisers. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a problem within our sector where we're still listening to them. Like, we're not even looking at the change. Like, you know, I keep like going back to this, you know, I attended ICON in the fall and I was shocked at how many old non-people of color were leading those workshops on the change. And I'm like, you've been part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Like, you have been the one perpetuating this problem for years. And now you're going to sit here and tell me how we need to change it? Like, this isn't even accurate. So I think because those are the experts, we're still looking for
those are the storytellers.
People. Right.
That's those are the storytellers. Those are the people
and now they're
the
jumping
story
on the bandwagon, like, oh, they're shifting. Yep. But it's like, But the younger guard, like, we've been trying to shift that, and you've been telling us we're doing it wrong. And now you're saying, oh, well, let's do it that way. You weren't even doing it that way. So we're still putting our faith, everyone, in those, well, some of us are, in those old, that old guard, whether they're the fundraisers or the donors, and no one's saying, okay, it's time for you to step aside.
Okay. So see if the two of you follow me on this. So I think I've got Monique convinced. I might have Valerie. This is my theory. It's completely developed. This is not completely developed, but hear me out here. Okay. So if the storytellers are actually the experts in our space, and we're convinced that arm's length fundraising, which means galas, golf tournaments, direct response, grant writing, right? Then what actually happens is that young fundraisers come into the space. They're not actually interacting with donors. They're actually just interacting with experts. And this is the writing that I'm working on, because I think the issue that we have in this space, and when I read your article, Valerie, I don't think it's the donors that are the problem. I think it's the people that we're putting up on the platform, allowing us to tell the story.
You know, I think the other thing is I came into this space very differently. So I started in for-profit business development. Right. So I worked for design companies, architecture firms, industrial design companies doing business development. So I had to actively reach out to the head of design at GE or the head of design at Black & Decker or Hilton to convince them to have a meeting with me to talk about how amazing my firm was so that I can at least get an RFP or to get a, you know, so coming in from that aspect, like, I came into the field that way when I switched over. So when it came to all of the online stuff and things like that, I was like, this doesn't really work this way. And especially Facebook fundraisers. I'm like, if you guys aren't asking whoever's doing your birthday fundraiser to tell you who gave you those dollars, there's no way for you to either follow up with those people to turn them into donors. They're just giving you $5 for a birthday. There has to be some other direct connection there. So I've never gotten that. I learned from my peers. When I went to my peers, I'm like, that doesn't really work right. So I think that we have to, you're right. You've now convinced me. right? So, the storytellers are telling it wrong. Yeah. They're telling those donors, oh, we're going to put your name on the building. Mm-hmm. Give us this money. And so now they expect that from everybody now, right?
No one's saying we're not doing this anymore. I didn't want to be right today, but I did want to. I think we've got a storytelling problem, not a donor problem. I think we got to get our fundraisers closer to the donor sooner in the process. Like what did you spend the first, Valerie, what did you spend the first 5 years of your fundraising? What did you spend your time doing?
My first job in fundraising was doing third-party fundraisers and workplace giving for a cancer research organization. Yeah. I went to a lot of, you know, United Way and combined federal campaign events all across the country. And that was kind of where my disenchantment began, because they were flying me across the country to go to these events where I would sit at a table for 2 hours and try and convince postal workers to give me part of their, you know, paycheck every week. And I'm certain, I ended up running the numbers right before I left, 100% certain we spent way more money to send me out there than we did getting back in return donations. So that was kind of where I started. And, you know, that was the beginning of the, why are we doing it like this? And then I moved to another organization that was very events focused. And again, had the, why do we do it like this? Like, it would be so much easier for me to just sit down and ask somebody for $50,000 than to spend 6 months planning this event where I get $50,000, but I have to spend half of it on renting the venue and feeding all the guests. So yeah, that's kind of how I got here.
Is the system that any of us, of the three of us, is the system that we're all essentially a part of going to get more likely to put you, Valerie, because you're a white woman versus Monique, a Black woman, is the system any more likely to put you in front of Mackenzie Scott or Robert Smith than it is to put the other one? Because I think what we've convinced ourselves of is that neither of you, and perhaps myself either, are qualified because maybe we lack credentials or we're not old enough. I think all three of us could sit in front of Mackenzie Scott and probably get the job done just fine. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. But I think we also have to look at, you know, because some of what Monique was saying back at the beginning, like, would she ever even get the opportunity as a Black woman to sit in front of some of these donors? Because the assumption is that the donors might not want to hear from a Black person in a fundraising role. And that's a whole other topic that we don't necessarily have to get into right now.
Because do they not want to sit down in front of Monique because she's a Black woman, or does the quote unquote donor not want to sit in front of a fundraiser regardless of who the fundraiser is?
So I am one of those confident fundraisers. Mm-hmm. I have no problem making a cold call, you know, getting to that, to get that meeting and doing what I need to do to get that meeting. And that comes from my business development background.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it really depends on the person, right? And where their mindset is, going back to, you know, whether it's the OGAR fundraiser, the OGAR donor, because like I said, like, I've actually been told, and I'm middle class, I'm not poor, but I am poor when you're considering that you guys are sitting on millions of dollars or whatever, but, and being told that, you know, you're not on my level, you know, you're not wearing designer clothes. And just because I don't care about brand labels, I can afford them. I just don't care about them.
Yeah.
But because I'm not dressing in designer labels and showing up in a Porsche, it's like, oh, you don't belong here. You don't belong at my country club to even come in here. And it's really funny because within that conversation, the first thing that came to my mind was in a petty kind of a way, like people who have more money, people who have more generational dollars welcome me into their homes and have more trust in me than you do. And your dollars aren't that old or stretched that far. So there's really this like mentality issue that's going on because I'm Black and I'm not in their circle.
Yeah.
So it's a combination. It really depends on a person. I think Mackenzie Scott would sit down with me.
I there know might she be would.
Others absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think Robert
and
Smith
And I think that's something
too.
The last...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something the last 4 years has taught us is that there's a lot more inherent bias and internal racism than we thought in this country. So, you know, the nonprofits are on the side of caution, right? Like if you have a donor that you don't know very well and you don't know what their inclinations are or who they may or may not be comfortable with, you're going to err on the side of let's put a white face in front of them so we don't run into any obstacles and lose the gift. So it's not necessarily just the donor's decision. It can be the nonprofit or, you know, the fundraising department's decision too, because we're so worried about getting the gift, not losing the gift, keeping the donor, that, you know, we kind of hedge our bets and we say like, all right, well, a white face in front of that person is a guarantee. Whereas a Black face or, you know, a Hispanic face in front of that person might turn them off and we don't know. So we're going to make sure we put a white person in front of them.
Yeah.
And the story, right? I mean, you know, there's a story. I was sitting in front of a donor and it was myself. I have 3 degrees. My president who has 3 degrees, right? So between us, we've got 6 degrees and we're the senior, you know, we're running this organization. And a donor said to us, like, you know, we do this work because if it's not for us, who would these kids have to look up to? And I was just kind of like, you're sitting across from 2 African-Americans who have 6 degrees between them and run an organization.
Yeah.
Like you're on your savior kick, right? Like, like they have their story in their mind and now I have to placate to it. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So like we now, so going back to, again, that the guard and who's telling the narrative, they have their narratives and it's hard to sometimes break away from that because I'm going to be like, no, like this is actually what's going on. And this is why we actually need your money. And it's like, you can't tell them how to spend their money. You can't tell them their beliefs. I'm like, but it's not even their beliefs. It's the needs of the community. Mm-hmm. So it's a struggle out here. And I don't know how long it's going to take for that conversion to happen. I don't know what burning it down really looks like. And, but
I don't think we need to burn it down.
Yeah.
I think I read yesterday that millennials are going to be at their peak income levels in the next 2 decades. So now is the time to really start to focus on millennials. And, you know, boomers are getting towards the end of their lifespan. So that is, you know, it's going to look very different to fundraise from millennials than it is to fundraise from, you know, boomers or even Generation X. So I think the change is coming. I really, really, really hope that fundraising looks a lot different in 10 years from now.
It has to, you know, and I think that if you just look at, you know, what was going on around the elections, around politics, like this generation is looking for accountability. And, you know, when I got into fundraising, you know, I ran a nonprofit as an ED and did the fundraising for a good 10 years. So I designed programs and I understood operations. And so when I went into another nonprofit as a DOD, I was meeting with the program staff. What's going on? I'm on site. I want to understand, okay, how is this working? What's not working? Where's your need? And they really said to me, like, the last development officer never spoke to us. And I was like, how did she never speak to you? Like, how could she fundraise for you? She did not understand what was going on in the program. How was she able to write grants? And she didn't know, you know, what was working, what was not working, and what was needed. And they were like, you know, when there was grants, she just, you know, sent us some questions, but like, she never actually came to program. Mm-hmm. And I was just that blew my mind, because as a fundraiser, you have to understand programming, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally.
You have to understand you have to know what you're fundraising for. Mm-hmm. Because if you're just going to worry about the dollars, then your story is off.
Yeah. Yep.
Your story is off.
Okay, so we're going to lose our listeners here in a minute, but I'm gonna send some applause out to our friend Vu on the West Coast in one of his more recent articles, mm-hmm. and this gets into some of the credentialing conversation and some of the things that we've talked about, but it's sort of a curveball thing that a conversation I'd like to wrap up on for the next 5 minutes or so, but. Isn't because I know a lot of the audience that, for example, Vu is oftentimes the community centered fundraising folks are talking to. They do a lot of grant writing. And one of the things that Vu has very boldly said is that maybe we just need to completely unplug this whole grant writing sort of thing altogether. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think when we talk about specialization, we talk about the stories that are being told. I think grant writing at its core is a control mechanism, both for the institution on the one side and the donor on the other. And it's completely dysfunctional. There's no mm-hmm. humanity in it. I don't get to see the other person on the exchange. I don't care who you are on the other side. But if we dared to just say, look, that's not how we're going to let relationships work. I didn't negotiate the relationship with my wife and children and my I'm not negotiating my relationship with the two of you with a grant, with a, you know, a proposal. Mm-hmm. Should we necessarily do that with people that are writing us $100,000 checks?
Yeah. So yeah. Trust-based philanthropy is starting to catch some wind in the philanthropy, you know, areas, and it's basically foundations committing to trusting their nonprofit partners and not requiring a whole mess of reports and really, really long grant applications and just kind of trusting in the process. And I have to say, I have a couple of funders who have really committed to that process. And, you know, they asked for a very simple proposal. They have started to do multi-year fundraising, general operating fundraising with very little restrictions. And they come out and they meet with us once or twice a year. And they really ask us what's going on, what's working, what's not working. And we have, you know, a more candid conversation about, you know, everything that's going on with us as an organization and how their funds are helping. And it's made a huge difference for those funders. I spend a lot more time stewarding those relationships, or a lot less time. I spend a lot less time writing proposals or reports for them. But they've significantly increased what they're giving to us. Whereas on the flip side, the funders who haven't really embraced that model, I spend more time reporting, I spend more time writing proposals, and I spend very little face time with those funders. So I would love to see funders move in that direction, but we also have to remember we can't just completely cut out all of our funding and say we're not doing grants anymore, because some organizations would fold if they didn't have that grant funding. So it's on the funders too. The funders have to really commit to this, or else it's, you know, nonprofits aren't going to be able to pull out of that relationship completely.
Right. I mean, so our organization is actually working on a platform that allows for more trust-based philanthropy and sharing of data to kind of change that grant process. But also, I sit on the board of the Philadelphia Black Giving Circle, as well as Union Benevolent Association. And, you know, we're trying to really just like do away with them to a point, right? Very minimal. We have grant cycles where we just basically take suggestions from the community. Who's doing the work?
Yeah.
Who's helping you? Yeah. send us some recommendations. We'll do our own research. We'll look into them. We'll pull their 990s. You know, we'll do all the necessary work on our end and just call them and say, congratulations, you got a check. Yeah. Right. So, you know, it really depends on the, it has to start with the funder and allowing them to remove those restrictions and that control and really just trusting the community and trusting those organizations.
Yeah. See, when we, and this brings us full circle. If we're trying to fix, let's say that we genuinely and honorably want to fix fundraising, which is essentially which was sort of the core of your critique, Valerie. Again, we'll put a link in the extraordinary sort of provoking conversation, and I appreciate you both being here. But if we could sort of dismantle our assumption, our professional identities, if we could remove our professional identities from things like grant writing. And we could, in my mind, if we could more so sort of hinge them on lunch table, coffee table, Zoom meetings, the three of us probably come from very different worlds, but yet we've been able to have an honorable, meaningful conversation for nearly an hour. We need to be able to do this for with our donors as well, whether it's Mackenzie Scott or, you know, Robert Smith or, you know, Jane Doe.
Agree. Most definitely. We need to be able to agree to disagree and sit down and really hear each other, like actually hear and listen and not just hear with your preconceived notions ready to talk, but just listen.
So you guys are thinking about a podcast, right? You're going to try to give me some competition. Am I right?
So we have really great conversations with each other. And like Monique said earlier, we say a lot of the same things when we're writing about fundraising and philanthropy and the types of things that we're involved in. So we wanted to put together a podcast where we could talk to each other and talk to other folks and really challenge that notion of who our experts are in fundraising, kind of what we talked about, like bring in new voices, bring in new thoughts and new ideas. So we are going to launch a podcast very soon, and we're calling it Beyond Philanthropy.
Cool.
And we are officially on Instagram and Twitter, so you can find us there and follow us. And hopefully we will have some episodes out to you soon.
Well, I promise to be one of your biggest fans. I promise. And I'd be delighted to be one of your guests. And I'll let you all hop on your soapboxes, just like I hopped up on a few of mine. Just one of the privileges of being the host. That's all. One of the things I always like to wrap up on, though, is people know how to find me, but they may not know how to find you. So, Valerie, how about you start? Monique, you wrap us up. If somebody's listening to their conversation today, they're like, I want to reach out to Valerie. How do you suggest that they do that?
I on Instagram and Twitter also at Val Runs Philly, which does not mean that I'm in charge of Philadelphia. It means that I'm a runner. So at Val Runs Philly.
Okay, good. And I'll put that in the show notes. How about you, Monique? How do we find you? It sounds like you've got probably a consulting website or something. Am I right?
Yeah, you can find more about our services at www.civiccapitalconsulting.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Civic Capital.
It has been a pleasure. I certainly enjoyed this conversation. You both kept up with me, and I look forward to having you back sometime. You both have a wonderful afternoon and a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.